This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. An in-depth investigation of privately owned nursing homes finds that cost-cutting and profits are often prioritized over patient safety and well-being. Over 70% of nursing homes in the United States are privately owned. Here in Wisconsin, 56% of certified nursing facilities were privately owned as of 2023, according to data from KFF. What does it mean for residents and staff when profit is part of the picture at a nursing home? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or a loved one live in some kind of nursing care facility? Is it for-profit or non-profit? Has it changed in recent years? Do you work in this business? Do you see a difference when for-profit companies take over nursing homes? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sean Campbell is an independent investigative journalist. He co-wrote a new report in The Conversation on for-profit nursing homes. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This is something I didn't know. I think maybe a lot of people may not have suspected. Why is for-profit business such a big player in nursing homes in Wisconsin and around the country?
Yeah, well, it might seem a little counterintuitive, but for-profit nursing homes and nursing home sector, by and large, is very profitable, despite what some nursing home providers may want people to believe. There's always this talk of constantly being cash trapped, but a congressional research service so found that this is at least half $1 trillion of government money flows into this industry. And not only are there profits from the direct payments, but for-profit nursing homes can also own the pharmacy that's associated with providing medications or the staffing industry or business that provides staffing. So not only do these businesses get to profit off of the nursing home itself, but they get to provide the ancillary services as well to increase their profits.
Before we get into what this means for people who actually live at these nursing facilities, I want to talk a little more about the revenue here. As you mentioned, industries might point toward what look like not huge bottom lines, not huge profit margins. But you mentioned they might be profiting from the pharmacy. Also, a big part of this is real estate. So if I'm hearing this story, this is interesting to me, Sean. If I run one of these private equity or other corporations, I buy into the nursing home business. I then sell the land under the buildings to another entity that I also have a stake in. Then I charge a very big rent and maybe management and operating fees for that land. So it's another way to extract money from nursing homes. That's part of where the money's going?
Yes. In a number of cases, and a number of cases that we talk about in our article, with a real estate investment trust, a private company, a private equity company, oftentimes will start up another company that will buy the real estate from out underneath the nursing home and then charge that nursing home rents. So the rents can stay stable or they can increase over time. And that same company that owns the nursing home is essentially paying itself money for rent. And over time, as the rent can increase, and in some cases does increase, this can then be used as a reason to say that, well, this nursing home isn't profitable. We have to find a way to cut costs, maybe reduce staffing. That's often a thing that's raised by a number of these for-profit nursing homes, is that they can't afford a certain staffing level. But when you really parse who owns each individual company, more often than not, you will find that the costs that are really burdening the nursing home trace back to the original owners. Whether it be real estate is a big one, and pharmacy, as I mentioned before, or staffing agencies. And another aspect that makes this as kind of a second layer of profitability is if the nursing home fails, you have that real estate investment trust that has the land. So the nursing home can be going under, it's no longer salvageable. So then the real estate investment trust can then sell the land from underneath the nursing home, and the nursing home can close, generating another kind of wave of profits here.
Talking about for-profit ownership of nursing homes in the U.S., Sean Campbell wrote a big piece on this in The Conversation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Sean, a focus, of course, of your piece is what this means for patients at nursing homes. You open with an example in, this is Louisville, Kentucky, an outfit mm-hmm. called Landmark, owned by a company called Infinity Healthcare Management. This seems, I hope, is a worst case. Can you talk about what you saw there?
Yeah. So I will start this off too by saying that this was one of the worst cases, but not an outlier in terms of when you look at some of these for-profit middle tier, as we call them, nursing home chains, this isn't an anomaly. But at Louisville, the Landmark facility there that's owned by Infinity Healthcare, the facility was a mess. This is inspector saying this wasn't me. Even one of the own staff said that the condition seemed unsanitary. The residents were roaming the halls. In two instances, at least, there was sexual touching between the residents, which borders on sexual assault when we talk about people that might not be cognizant of their own surroundings. So this was a very bad case, and they were fined substantially for it. But Infinity actually owns a number of poor performing nursing homes that aren't too far off from Landmark. And since the story has published, even in Kentucky, there's facilities that outpace the level of fines of Landmark at Louisville. So again, this was a bad case where you have sexual touching, you have in one instance, an assault from a nursing and staff pushing down a resident and injuring them. But it's by far not alone.
You mentioned fines. Who is in charge of regulating these nursing homes and deciding if a company should be able to buy more of them?
Yeah, so the predominant organization that's in charge of regulating these nursing homes is the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS for short. That's run through the federal government, and it's a little bit of a structured way of overseeing this. There are state inspectors, and then there are federal inspectors, and then there can also be another layer of oversight that's particular to each state that can be run by state health departments or local health departments. So there's all of this kind of comes together in the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, but the inspectors can come from multiple areas. And this is, again, a part because over $460 billion flows into this industry annually. So it behooves the federal government to take an ownership of regulating and looking after to these nursing homes to make sure there's some level of oversight and care being given.
And when it comes to these fines, are they seen as a sufficient deterrent or something that once a company receives them seems to turn around their behavior?
So fines are an easy way to kind of put a dollar amount to harm, to poor care. But when you actually factor in how much money they can make on a monthly or annual basis, it's not that much. But fines typically lead to what can really hurt a nursing home, which are payment denials. This is once you have these levels of repeated high fines and numerous lapses of care, CMS can cut off the payments that come from the federal government. And that can really, that basically just cuts off the flow of money into the nursing home. So the company has a vested interest in terms of fixing this. So I want to put that out there too, where mm-hmm. fines are significant and the next level up from the fines, which isn't as easy for people to kind of wrap their heads around, are payment denials where money is actually cut off from the facilities. Now, this is an incentive to get their act together, but again, like we talked about before, these can be incredibly profitable, especially when you're paying yourself money for taking care of the residents. So it's an incentive to improve your profitability. But in some cases, and with some of the more problematic owners that we found, it's not as much of an incentive to provide good care as we would hope.
We're talking to journalist Sean Campbell about a new report on for-profit nursing home companies and their records of fines and cost-cutting. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What has your experience been like with nursing homes? If you've been to one yourself or have a loved one there or you work there, have you seen positive or negative experiences? Do you think it matters if one is operated for profit or non-profit? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up a conversation about the for-profit nursing home industry. Over 70% of nursing homes in the U.S. are privately owned, over half in Wisconsin. Our guest investigation found lots of concerns, including safety and well-being of patients. Sean Campbell stays with us, investigative journalist based in New York. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Ron is with us in Poinette. Ron, hi.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air, Ron. What did you want to bring up?
I'm curious. How do you find out if a nursing home is privately owned or what you're talking about, the corporation? Mm-hmm. I'm 80 years old. I hope I don't have to go into one. But why is this legal in the United States?
Ron, thanks a lot for the call. First of all, transparency, Sean. Is it easy to tell if a company is for-profit or non-profit? If it's for-profit, is it easy to tell who actually owns it?
So CMS does have this information. When you go to Care Compare, you can look up nursing homes from their website, and they'll give you a star rating system, and it will give you those kinds of information as to whether they're for-profit, government-owned, or non-profit. There is also, to give a little plug here for ProPublica, ProPublica has the Nursing Home Compare that has even more granular information, has all the information that CMS has, but makes it more easy to not only see what the star ratings are, but to also pull up what some of the more recent reports have been, inspection reports, so you can see how many times they've been fined. But by and large, the star rating system is fine, but it has its problems. The inspections, that's another way of judging care, but it's hard to really judge a nursing home just by the care of when an inspector goes in there and what they see. It's another metric that you can use, for-profit, private, or non-profit, another thing that you kind of use to really understand. The new piece of information, which what our investigation focused on, which was really linking the chains together, which is something that CMS started doing last year, where they have what's called affiliated entities, which you can also see with Nursing Home Compare. It'll tell you what their affiliated entity is. But looking and seeing what the affiliated entities are, I feel, is probably the best bet to judge the quality of a nursing home. When we looked at these figures, and we talked about the mid-sized chains that seem to be the poor performers compared to one-off owners or people that just own a handful of nursing homes, or even the largest for-profit companies, the mid-sized groups seem to have the most issues with them. But there are good nursing home chains. There are good for-profit nursing home chains, and it shows across their facilities. And these are the facilities that will typically have higher overall quality rating, lower levels of fines, all sorts of the metrics that you want to look at. If there is quality within those chains, I think it's a good bet that that facility is also going to be of a higher quality. So it's not as easy as it should be to really differentiate the good from the bad, but there are ways to do it using some of the tools I mentioned. And at least recently, some of this transparency is improving, if not nearly as good as it could be.
Thanks again for that call. We'll go to Elizabeth now in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
I'm sorry, excuse me.
That's okay.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. We had a pretty bad experience with my mother being in a basically a Medicare-funded nursing home. Excuse me, I'm sorry. medication mix-ups. Within a week, she had a wrist sprain issue, found out that some CNAs were not even fully certified, yet this place touted their lovely little dining room with their, you know, tablecloths and whatnot. That seemed to be more important to present to people. And it was pretty sad. And I think, you know, some people don't have a choice as to what type of nursing home they can go into. Some of the wealthier people can go into nicer places, and that issue isn't there. I know for a fact because I visited people at nicer places.
Sure, Elizabeth, thanks a lot for the call. Sorry for that experience. You look in your piece at research, Sean, on you know what happens when these facilities go from nonprofit to for-profit in some cases. I think JAMA, there was research published. What do we see when it comes to increased risks of health hazards like that, even emergency room visits?
Yeah. For what I want to say, I'm sorry for your experience, caller. Yeah, these things can be difficult. And when we talk about when they switch from nonprofit or government to for-profit, generally we see a decline in quality. We see an even larger decline in quality when they move from into the hands of private equity companies, which private equity by and large emphasizes short-term returns on profits. So it's not kind of the long-term investment that you would hope for or want. I wouldn't even say hope for, that you would want or need when it comes to nursing home care, because these are people that have substantial health issues. That's where you see an even larger decline. And there's research that backs up that as well, that over a period of time when private equity firms get involved, we see declines in care and even outcomes, higher risk mortality, adverse events, like you mentioned, medication mix-ups. Mm-hmm. What will happen with a lot of these companies, like the caller alluded to there, is that when people come in, people often don't have a choice. Sometimes your family member is infirmed or they suddenly just started showing signs of dementia and can't care for themselves, or they don't have the money to really look after them themselves at home, which can be incredibly expensive. So a lot of attention can be given to the aesthetics of a facility, but the underlying care of staffing or the people who are being staffed, the level of management oversight, those are the areas where you can cut costs, and a layperson walking in wouldn't necessarily know the difference. Everything would just look good. It's only until something bad happens that you begin to question that. So these are all the things that we do see with research, that lower levels of staffing, private equity ownership, these can all lead to reductions in care. The movement to for-profit also shows generally a reduction in care, but as I mentioned before, there are some very good for-profit facilities. There's just there's fewer than them than there are the nonprofit or government facilities.
Thanks for that call. Sean Campbell is with us. We're talking about a piece he wrote in The Conversation about for-profit businesses in the nursing home industry. Back to your calls now. Mary Kay is with us in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hello. Mary Kay, are you there? I think we lost her. Let's try George in Wanakee. George, hi.
Hi, Rob. This is George. I'm the retired state long-term care ombudsman for Wisconsin. And I remember when I was working, we were examining the vertical integration of the long-term care system in the for-profit sector, running from group homes, assisted living, nursing homes, and then discovered that there was in terms of the for-profit sector, a relationship to the larger Hospital Corporation of America, as well as some of the hotel chains such as Marriott. And I'm wondering if your examination looked at the impact of that sort of integration.
George, thanks a lot for the call. Sean, have you seen that sort of, I know some of the companies you write about also own at least healthcare facilities.
We didn't look into the hospital, or not the hospital, the hotel ownership, but there is this kind of vertical integration that where there are, they can own healthcare facilities, where again, you could have a resident who you look after in your nursing home that you can then say, this person needs care, specialized care, and then send them to one of your facilities that you also own to receive that specialized care, and then charge however much money you want to charge for that. Well, you know, within reason, where you then get to pay yourself the money and then also record it as a loss on your nursing home. So this is the one of the ways that nursing home operators can kind of gripe about being an industry that isn't very profitable. They're not making much money, but because they can charge themselves essentially high rates for things like integrated healthcare services. So yes, we do have that, and we mentioned that in the story, along with, as I mentioned before, with the real estate investment trust, where not only are you charging yourself for services, you're also charging yourself for rent.
George, thanks for that call. Sean, in just our last few moments, are there any changes in regulation maybe in the works or being called for here?
There are some things that advocates have been asking for and calling for. I will also say that with the Biden administration, we have seen a noticeable uptick in fines and enforcement, a very substantial uptick, more than anywhere else. And so things are in the works for getting some regulation there. But I would argue, and I think most people who work in this sector, at least from the patient care standpoint, would say that not enough has been done. We definitely need more transparency so we can notice the bad actors, easily suss them out, and decide where we're going to take our loved ones. And then there's more regulation that could happen in terms of how are you recording your profits? Are you paying yourself a market rate? These are some of the things, and also local prosecutors can also be more in charge of levying lawsuits against the homes that can.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Sean Campbell, a journalist. His new piece in The Conversation digs into the for-profit nursing home industry. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Governor Evers signed a series of bills into law last week aimed at preventing human trafficking. The new legislation included a bipartisan effort to create a new human trafficking council within the State Department of Justice, create more funding for grant programs that support victims, and require certain employers to train employees on identifying and preventing human trafficking. Democratic State Representative Jody Emerson of Eau Claire sat on the Speaker's task force that put forward a lot of these proposals. She said earlier this year that laws like these emphasize that collective action is needed to deal with the issue.
Human trafficking is one of those crimes where we don't often have a victim who is calling 911 to report that crime. If any of us had our car stolen, you better believe that we would, you know, grab the phone right away. And so when we are talking about fighting the crime of human trafficking, we need to empower people in the community to know what it looks like, because it doesn't look like it does on Law and Order and various movies. It has a different approach to it, and to be able to say something seems off here.
We're taking a look at the issue of human trafficking in Wisconsin and how well the state does at preventing and responding to these crimes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How important of an issue is human trafficking to you? Have you worked on issues like this in your own community? Join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. A note that this conversation may include descriptions of incidents that could be unsettling or disturbing. If you or a loved one needs help with human trafficking and the consequences of it, you can call the 24/7 National Human Trafficking Hotline at 1-888-373-7888. You can also text 233-733. Jan Miyazaki is director of Project Respect, a Dane County-based anti-human trafficking organization that promotes prevention, intervention, and survivor empowerment. Jan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Let's start off with the very basics here. How do we define what human trafficking is in the first place?
Wow. So that, I don't think there's any short answer. Mm-hmm. There is a difference between how we define it between juveniles and adults. So human trafficking for juveniles is the procurement, harboring, transporting, any way that a child is delivered for the purpose of a commercial sex act or for some kind of labor exploitation for anything of value. With adults, the law looks for elements of force, fraud, or coercion to establish that trafficking has occurred.
And people might think of something of human trafficking as something that happens elsewhere, not in Wisconsin. I know by the very nature of it, it might be hard to put numbers on, but it does exist. It is something that happens clearly in Wisconsin, right, Jen?
Yes. It happens sort of anywhere, rural or urban, because the demand to purchase sex, for instance, you know, crosses all lines and is ultimately what propagates this kind of exploitation.
Is this part of the problem that we need a solution for, that we need a better understanding of the scope of the problem? Do we need to be doing more just to know how widespread this is?
I mean, I think that's a good first step. And one of the pieces of legislation that passed that you mentioned was the establishing of a human trafficking council. And one of the council's tasks is to do data collection. And I think that is important because we need to have a better sense of how this is occurring in our state. It's a really, I think, a good effort to start with. It's bringing together the Wisconsin Department of Justice, the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction, and the Department of Children and Families. And ideally, I think if you're working at prevention, we would want to also include the public health department. But it's really an important new council. Its job will be to do data collection, and then not only to collect it, but to analyze it, because we need people who can crunch the data.
One of those pieces of new legislation I mentioned that just got signed into law, one that mandates human trafficking training for employees at a bunch of different places, residential facilities, hotels, motels, adult entertainment establishments, public transit workers. Can you talk about what kind of training might be useful in helping people spot human trafficking in progress?
Well, I mean, I think that's helpful. What I thought was really valuable inside of that legislation was particularly training to those who work in community-based residential facilities. Mm-hmm. And when we think of those kinds of places, we often think of senior citizen facilities, but it also includes facilities for folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities are just more likely to become victims of sexual assault. They're more vulnerable and more vulnerable to human trafficking. So I think what's really important about that was in the kind of group homes or housing, assisted living for people with this disability.
Jan Miyazaki is with us, director of Project Respect. That's a group in Dane County that works on anti-human trafficking efforts, promotes prevention, intervention, survivor empowerment. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we talk about the issue and new state legislation. Again, that's 800-642-1234. Jan, I wanted to ask about your work with survivors in particular. What kind of things do you do at Project Respect to help them?
The survivor identifies, you know, what is driving this, and often it might be issues around economic insecurity and housing insecurity. It could be some kind of health issue. So it can depend, but we do offer here mental health therapy, peer support group, intensive case management, really, you know, breaking down the barriers that exist within our systems to victims accessing needed services. We do accompaniment to interviews, whether it's with law enforcement or forensic nurse examiners, you know, just to name a few.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Paul joins us in Toma. Paul, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Everything your guest just mentioned is exactly what's kind of happening to a woman that I met in Arizona. I'm a former retired Department of Defense employee, so I've been through that trafficking in persons many times. When I was out there in Arizona, I lived in a junkyard, kind of a guy's dream come true. And so we got a lot of the homeless coming through there, and a woman came through looking for help. She wasn't looking for money. She was looking for somebody to buy her books. And I said, sure, I can do that. And as I got to know her, I believe she may be what's called a mule, where she's a good-looking lady, 54 years old, undergraduate master's degree, and I worked with a friend of mine who's retired borderline patrol in who lives in Phoenix. And it sounds like she's in a situation that she can't get out of for health, economics, housing, all of these issues, and she's in kind of what's called a panic mode. My friend who's retired law enforcement said that could be the drug MDMA, and that whoever trafficking her is using her as a mule. Everywhere she went, she carried a black plastic bag. Mm-hmm. My friend said, be careful if you ever look in that. You might have a decision to make.
Paul, thanks for the call. I don't want to go too deep into the particular details there, but Jan, if someone is in Paul's situation, suspects someone they know or interact with is being trafficked, I would have no idea what to do. What is out there? What kind of resources could they reach out towards?
First, I want to say that in terms of screening and identifying victims, we're really looking at addressing the drivers of trafficking. So for us, we're going to be partnering with those. He mentioned this potential victim as being homeless. We partner with folks who are serving this community so that we can access the consumers of their services and get to know them and build relationships so that over time they will trust us and disclose to us the nature of their circumstances. In regard to the caller, you know, in our community, the Madison Police Department has a tip line. And so that is specifically for human trafficking. I don't know what community in Wisconsin you're calling from, but you could give a tip to your police department, or you could give a tip to the Wisconsin Department of Justice.
Thanks for the call, Paul. We're talking about human trafficking here in Wisconsin, new state laws aimed at preventing it and detecting it. Our guest is Jan Miyazaki, director of the Dane County-based social service agency Project Respect. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you received training on human trafficking prevention or intervention, maybe in your line of work or in your community? Do you have questions about what we can do about the problem? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Jan Miyazaki, director of Project Respect, a Dane County-based organization that works on anti-human trafficking projects, including prevention and survivor empowerment. She's with us today to talk about human trafficking in Wisconsin after Governor Evers signed a new set of bipartisan laws aimed at reducing trafficking and supporting victims. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see Wisconsin do when it comes to preventing human trafficking? What questions do you have? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jan, we talked in particular about that training that was for many people in many lines of work when it comes to human trafficking. In this new package of legislation, what are the other things that might have stood out to you as being particularly important?
Rob, what I wanted to add that the caller, mm-hmm. Sure. It might answer the question that the caller had, is that inside of the Human Trafficking Council, it calls for someone within any local law enforcement, you know, municipal law enforcement, county law enforcement, that somebody have the job of coordination, prevention, training, and enforcement, that somebody would be the point person. And so I think, you know, we're fortunate in Dane County to have someone like that, but the Human Trafficking Council legislation calls for that. And so I think that's really great to have somebody to be designated to do all the training and prevention work, or at least to coordinate it.
I know a concern in the past, Jan, is that a victim of trafficking, especially sex-related trafficking, might be concerned about being charged with a crime as something related to prostitution themselves if they were to report this. Is this something you see changing in law enforcement and prosecution over time?
You know, from the victim service provider standpoint, you know, we are really mindful of a victim's rights and why they come forward and how important it is to ensure their privacy. And so there's no so to come to a victim service provider, we take a victim-centered approach. The victim, and talking about adult victims can tell us whether or not they want law enforcement involved. The law enforcement that we partner with most frequently are trained and are not looking to make those kinds of arrests, but trying to get to, you know, the larger crime, which would be the trafficking. I would point out that something that didn't pass, though, is that we still have on the books in Wisconsin the crime of juvenile prostitution. And ideally, we would like to get that off the books simply because that conflicts with the juvenile anti-human trafficking or sex trafficking legislation. To get that off the books and then to sort of undertake, you know, a study to determine how we can provide needed social services to those young people.
Are there systemic things you'd like to see, Jan, done to make sure that people who are vulnerable to trafficking are less vulnerable? And I can imagine that taking a lot of different forms. Are there wider changes you'd like to see?
Wow, where do I start? I think that the concern that you raised about a victim being charged with prostitution, I think that if they're not identified as a victim, but more as a perpetrator of a crime, then, you know, they get that charge, and that charge can really impact their ability to get jobs, to get housing. And so, you know, good, you know, systemic change move would be to, you know, to expand the current expungement provisions in the Wisconsin statutes to include, you know, any offense where a victim was induced or compelled to commit while they were trafficked. Because right now there were just some few named offenses. But that is one that could be a real game changer in the person's life.
Doing the work you do in Dane County, Jen, other people might look in and say, yes, we'd like to have something like Project Respect in our community. If they're some kind of service provider or in law enforcement, or the list goes on. If someone wanted to do a similar project in their part of the state, how would you recommend they get started?
You know, there are a number of programs that I know that are sprouting up here in our state. And, you know, I encourage that. There is a set of standards and core competencies that were established by in 2017 by the Wisconsin Anti-Human Trafficking Task Force, led by DOJ and DCF, that they can look up, so that that could be really helpful. We could be providing education to those who want to open up these kinds of facilities to help prepare them to meet those standards if they are not yet there. And then there's kind of a step down where folks might be interested in sponsoring a host home. And again, helping to understand what the regulations are around host home, and then how to, you know, meet that requirement.
Jan Miyazaki is with us, director of Project Respect, a Dane County-based social service agency that provides services to people victimized by sex trafficking. The state has a series of new laws just signed in, bipartisan bills passed into law, dealing with different components of that issue. Jan, the National Anti-Sex Trafficking Organization Shared Hope International gave Wisconsin and a lot of other states F grades on report cards for sex trafficking response, prevention, and training. Now, it's not your organization, it's another one, but do you see in Wisconsin and other states just a lack of effort, a lack of programs to try to deal with trafficking?
Well, I would expect that after these three pieces of legislation, that score should improve, because what Shared Hope International is looking at are the rules and the laws and what we have in place. I think that if we enact the safe harbor legislation, which is taking juvenile prostitution off the books, I think we would jump up significantly even more. So Shared Hope International is looking at those kinds of pieces when they grade a state. And I think looking at the new legislation, I think will already elevate us. And then looking forward, would love to see the elimination of juvenile prostitution and the enactment of what we call safe harbor legislation for kids that are would formerly had been classified as juvenile prostitutes, which is completely a misnomer.
One aspect of the new legislation is grants to help victims of sex trafficking. What kind of resources would you see like to see? What kind of things would be helpful in helping people who have been through this to come out as best they can on the other side?
No, you know, Rob, I couldn't confirm if that one passed, but
okay.
It would have been great if it has, or if it, the yes, I mean, I think it would get to that need to provide some seed money on the ground for people to do a pilot program in their community, inside maybe of an existing sexual assault center or inside of a child advocacy center, because that might not be enough to fully establish something independent. But I think that would be great to do that. I'm hoping you're right. I'm hoping that it passed.
I believe that did. I will try to double check that. Or at least some grant money was signed in on one of these bills. I'm not sure if the full proposed package was. Jan, we haven't talked about one part of the problem, the perpetrators of sex trafficking. Are we doing enough, do you think, to pursue them? What do you see if we need more? What kind of changes would you like to see?
Well, you know, it is the case that it is the demand for purchased sex or the demand for, you know, cheap labor that drives and propagates this, right? So that is a fact. However, I think if we address what creates the vulnerabilities, that we could starve that demand. And so, you know, there are... there are those that are really looking at demand responses, and that can be really effective. I know that law enforcement and others are looking, you know, continuously look at that. But from a victim service provider end of it, I want to kind of work on this even further upstream, mm-hmm. and, you know, deal with the conditions that, you know, make people vulnerable and kind of starve off this demand.
Jan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Jan Miyazaki, Director of Project Respect, a Dane County-based social service agency that provides services to people victimized in sex trafficking. She was with us today to talk about human trafficking in Wisconsin and a new set of bipartisan bills signed into law by Governor Evers to help combat the issue. If you or a loved one needs help dealing with human trafficking, the National Human Trafficking Hotline is available 24 hours a day. You can call 888-373-7888. That's 888-373-7888. Or text the number 233-733. Again, 233-733. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, dig into the world of metal detecting here in Wisconsin and around the world and find out why people are questing to find buried curiosities. And you could start joining in right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. Is this a hobby of yours, or have you given it a try going around looking for whatever you find with a metal detector? Are you a fan of that show? What is it? The Detectorists, I think it's called, the one from the UK. I know it's got a big fan base as well. You could join that conversation right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Then tune in tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. This weekend marked the 85th birthday of a huge figure in American pop culture. March 30th, 1939 marked the first appearance of Batman, a.k.a. Bruce Wayne, the Caped Crusader, the Dark Knight, Old Maskface, and so on. Batman made his debut in issue 27 of Detective Comics, which gave the name to DC Comics, home of Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, and many more. Batman's had a lot of looks and styles, restarts and reboots over the years in comics, graphic novels, TV, and movies. There was a big trend for a while of that gritty approach to Batman, as opposed to the lighter-hearted Batman TV series of the 60s. I saw some panels from that original Detective Comics version where Batman punches a bad guy into a vat of acid and feels pretty okay with it, so that dark edge was there from the beginning. By the way, along with Batman slash Bruce Wayne, Commissioner Gordon was there right from the start. The world had to wait another year for Robin and the Joker. Bat news you can bat use. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll talk to the UW-Milwaukee alum who helps run the only bonobo research facility in the world right here in the Midwest. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Madison business owner. It's part of a series we're airing this month on women in southern Wisconsin in partnership with Midwest Mujeres.
Shadeira Kilfoy Flores of Madison says she's often felt like a caretaker.
Well, I'm a mom. I'm a community member of a number of different communities.
That includes working with young people in Madison.
There's a lot of mommying that I do behind closed doors, mostly to LGBTQ, Black and brown youth who, for whatever reason, may not have supportive parents at home.
Plus, you can add artist, garden organizer, and chef to that resume. She told me about this as part of a storytelling partnership with Midwest Mujeres in Madison. Kilfoy Flores has always been politically active, but there was one incident in Madison that changed everything for her.
Yeah, it's a hard one. My neighbor was killed by a police officer. And he wasn't just a neighbor. He was a family friend. He was a friend of my daughter's. He was a son of friends of mine.
That friend was Tony Robinson Jr., the 19-year-old shot and killed by a Madison police officer in 2015.
And it's been very, very hard to see the snowball of damage that his death has created.
Robinson's death sparked widespread demonstrations in the city. The Dane County District Attorney did not press charges against police officer Matt Kenny, who fatally shot Robinson. The family has worked for years to try to change that. Kilfoy Flores and her daughter, Serena Flores, channeled their grief by participating in the protests. Then, Serena got arrested at a demonstration outside her high school.
You know, she cried about the loss of freedom and that she had never felt so degraded and scared all at the same time. And I don't know that you ever heal from having your freedom taken away.
The charges against her daughter were later dropped. But this moment, paired with the shooting, made Kilfoy Flores want to do more. So she joined Madison's Police Civilian Oversight Board, the first of its kind in the state.
But the biggest difference is that Madison now has our very first independent police monitor.
The board works with that monitor and makes recommendations around police use of force and discipline. Kilfoy Flores is now the chair, and one of her goals is to create a safer community for civilians and officers.
I'm hoping that this can be a sustainable tool for accountability, but also for creating a bridge for community to be able to have more input in how we're being policed as well.
Kilfoy Flores has big goals. Once her time with the Police Oversight Board is up, she'd like to focus her attention on creating local, state, and federal legislation surrounding police accountability. And in the meantime, she hopes to encourage others to stand up for the issues they believe in.
Be the change that you want to see. If you see that something needs to happen, sometimes you got to make it happen yourself. We cannot always depend on others making the changes that we want. Sometimes you got to get off your duff and make it happen.
Shadeira Kilfoy Flores told us her story as part of a partnership with Midwest Mujeres in Madison. We've partnered with the organization to share stories of women who live in southern Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. Bonobos are one of humankind's closest primate relatives, along with chimpanzees. And the only facility in the world committed to the care, preservation, and research of bonobos is here in the Midwest. Our next guest is a UW-Milwaukee alum who helps run the program here for a look at what they do and what we can learn about from bonobos about our own evolution. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you heard of bonobos? What do you know about them? What questions do you have about ape research and conservation? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Amanda Epping is the Director of Operations at the APE Initiative in Des Moines, Iowa. She earned her bachelor's and master's degrees in anthropology at UW-Milwaukee. Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, people are probably pretty familiar with chimps. Not as many maybe know a lot about bonobos. I know less about them than I do chimps. Give us bonobo basics. Who are they? What do they do?
Sure. So bonobos, along with chimps, like you mentioned, are our closest living relatives. However, bonobos are just a little bit different, and I think because we are so familiar with chimps, maybe I'll start with how they're different than chimps. So bonobos are only found sort of south of the Congo River in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, whereas chimps and certainly the very charismatic gorillas are found sort of widespread throughout Africa. And then I think a really important difference is that bonobos are a matriarchal society. So the females are in charge, mom and all her friends kind of rule the roost, for lack of a better word, and the boys just sort of need to fall in line. And then another kind of really big difference is that chimps really like to eat fruit, gorillas really like to eat leaves, bonobos are sort of happy eating either. So they are one of the great apes and very, very closely related to chimps and us.
And one concern, obviously, is they are endangered. How worried are we about the bonobos' future?
So the bonobos are extremely endangered because they are endemic to that area. So the population estimate is as few as 20,000. And when they use language like that for a population estimate, I think that always kind of tells us we're really not sure how many there are. We just know there aren't very many.
Take us to the APE Initiative. What goes on there?
Yeah, so the APE Initiative, we are a nonprofit. We're the only non-zoo facility in all of North America that has bonobos. So there's us. There are seven zoos in all of North America that have them, including actually Milwaukee County Zoo has the largest population of bonobos. And then we collaborate with scientists from across the globe on different behavioral and cognitive research projects to understand bonobos, and then kind of through bonobos, kind of using bonobos as a window into our own place in the natural world. That's really sort of our main stick. While we're not open to the public, We do host both in-person and virtual education experiences for students and educators, kind of hoping that same, that connection with the bonobos can lead to further discovery and interest and sort of inspire that next generation. The facility is built on 230-ish acres in Des Moines proper. Des Moines is the capital of Iowa. So it's really unique that in the capital city, we have this big kind of chunk of land. The building itself is about 20,000 square feet. We've got 18 different indoor enclosures, 4 different outdoor enclosures, and we give the bonobos as much choice as we possibly can for, you know, where they want to go, which of the other six, we have 7 total, so which of the 7 bonobos they want to spend their time with, and sort of like give them lots of choices in the day. In a perfect world, they work on one research project every day, and they do one, you know, we ask the bonobos to sort of help us help them, so participate in training and stuff so we can make sure that they're happy, healthy, and you know, living the best life that they can.
A really interesting thing to me is it sounds like people from all over the world might apply, researchers from around the world might apply to work with your bonobos there, and they can do that if the bonobos are cool with it, right? The bonobo, you don't kind of force the bonobos to participate in the research that goes on there.
No. So if anyone's ever met a bonobo, you know that you really can't force a bonobo to do anything that they don't want to do. So we do, myself and really our whole team, we spend a lot of time, our director especially, kind of working with these researchers to make sure that we think that the bonobos will think the project is fun. We think that they'll want to do it. You know, we'll try to come up with a way that it's interesting and engaging to them. You know, if you think about it, like, they have a big brain and they're very smart and they're complex. And so stretching those brain muscles in theory should be sort of fun for them, sort of like us working on a puzzle. And so we encourage them, you know, to work on it, and we try to make it as fun for them as possible. But of course, if they don't want to, they just walk away. We don't withhold any food or anything from them. So it's always their choice. And it's always sort of a random hodgepodge of them who will participate in any given project.
Amanda Epping is with us, Director of Operations at the APE Initiative in Des Moines, Iowa. We're talking about our organization's bonobo research and conservation efforts and what our close relative species could tell us about human society and evolution. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Want to hear what you think, what questions you have. Have you ever seen the bonobos that Amanda mentioned at the Milwaukee County Zoo? It's a big group, the biggest group outside of their natural habitat. Join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Amanda Epping, UW-Milwaukee alum and Director of Operations at the APE Initiative in Des Moines, Iowa. We're talking about bonobos, how her organization researches, cares, works with them, and what they could teach us as one of humanity's closest primate relatives. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about bonobos? Have you seen them in action, maybe in the Milwaukee County Zoo? Join in at 800-642-1234. Amanda, I've used the phrase, you know, what they could teach us, bonobos could teach us about being human. I know we look a lot at our closest primate relatives to get ideas about what our earliest human ancestors might have been like. And the impression I get is if you're only looking at chimps, you're going to get one picture. How do bonobos fill out that picture of what it might mean to be human?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I think, you know, the end of the answer is going to be like, we are still trying to figure all of that out. But there are a lot of things that actually Franz de Waal, who's a famous researcher who recently, unfortunately, passed away, he said that if we walked into the forest and we saw bonobos first rather than chimpanzees, we would have never looked for another model for humans again. And I think that us, you know, I kind of mentioned that chimps are really interested in fruit. And if you think about the apple tree has 10 apples. And that's sort of, and there might be 20 chimps and there's 10 apples. And they really need to, they need to protect that resource. So a little bit, a little bit more territorial. And then on the other side of that, they kind of live in the same area as gorillas. Gorillas, because they live in the same area as chimps, sort of had to specialize to eating vegetation. And so bonobos are really the only apes that don't live among or at least in Africa, they don't live among other apes. And because of that, they may retain some more ancestral traits, right? Because they've got food, which has allowed their social behavior to really kind of flourish, because we're not so worried about the 10 apples in the apple tree. And so they may be a better model for early humans because they may retain more of those ancestral traits.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Aaron is with us in Wind Lake. Aaron, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Aaron?
Well, I wanted to know, what is the most surprising thing that Amanda has found out?
Oh, working with bonobos, Aaron, what is the biggest surprise so far for you, Amanda?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm not sure if anyone's ever asked me that. I think that, so some of these bonobos really early in their life were used in language research studies, and they are able to use a picture keyboard and communicate by touching a picture and saying, I would like orange juice, you know? But I think the most surprising thing for me is that the other bonobos, even bonobos who have come to live here in Des Moines from a zoo or, you know, somewhere else, didn't learn the language, the picture keyboard when they were really young, that it is, because they are so like us, it's very, very easy to communicate with them without having to use human language. One of my favorite things that happens at the facilities when we have kids here, the bonobos and the kids will start playing a game, and the bonobo understands the rules of the game and the kid understands the rules of the game, and they're running back and forth between the glass and they're both laughing and they're having a great time, and they were able to kind of communicate all of that through glass without using any words.
Aaron, thanks a lot for the question. Marcus is with us now in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So my question is, are the numbers of bonobos so low because of just them being hunted as bushmeat during the whatever 40, 50 year civil war or whatever you want to call it in the Congo? Or is it because of diseases? And then the second thing is, I have gone to the Milwaukee County Zoo since I was a kid. And one time I was with my grandpa watching them try and make it some bonobos to go back into a different portion of the cage. And the zookeeper said to us, you know, trying to force them to do anything, bonobos, it's a no-go.
Marcus, yeah, so, go ahead, Amanda.
I was going to say, yeah, bonobos can certainly be very stubborn.
And Marcus's question about what are the threats? Why are bonobo populations so low?
So he brought up a very good point that there's been a lot of civil unrest and bushmeat trade in that area of the Congo. So the biggest threats to bonobos are exactly that, bushmeat trade and deforestation. And then the other part is they're really kind of boxed in by that Congo River. So there isn't room for them to sort of expand outside of where they live. So as the forest gets smaller, of course, that only boxes them in more and more.
Thanks for the call, Marcus. And Amanda, at the APE Initiative, do you work with other organizations around the world on conservation?
We do have a partner in the Congo that we have been working with. And there is one sanctuary called Lola Ya Bonobo that is sort of working on trying to, before bonobos end up somewhere we don't want them to be, like in a privately owned, you know, home or something, they try to intercept that and re-release them into the wild before they end up in a situation where that's not possible.
And that, thanks again for the call, Mark, because that brings up a point. One of your missions there, I think, is to educate people that, you know, apes might look cool and in human-like in some ways, they are not pet material, really. It's not good for anybody. Is that right?
That is correct. We are so careful about what we put out in the world because we don't ever want to give the impression that, you know, even though these bonobos are really well trained and they love to work on a touchscreen computer, it certainly doesn't mean that you want one in your house working on a touchscreen computer. You know, we want these bonobos to be acting like bonobos, and we want to learn as much about them so we can provide them with all the things they need to live a happy bonobo life.
Let's bring on another caller now. Terry is with us in Milwaukee. Terry, hello.
Hi. I have a question. Mm-hmm. I am from Milwaukee, and when I go to the Milwaukee County Zoo, there really doesn't seem, because you said that the Milwaukee County Zoo has more bonobos than any other zoo, is very disheartening, because I think there's only like 5 or 6, if even that many. And the other question I have is, at your organization in Iowa facility, you say that you only have 6 or 7 bonobos there?
There's been a whole lot of bonobos since there's such a social family net. That's my question.
Terry, thanks for the call. Are there enough bonobos at each of those sites, Amanda, to give them the social connections that they need?
Yeah, it's a great question. I can't, unfortunately, speak a lot to Milwaukee's, you know, management of their bonobo group. I know they do have some areas that maybe aren't on exhibit. That could be part of that. And on our end, we do feel like 7 is probably not enough, and we're actively working with other facilities. So one thing that happens in bonobo society, both in the wild, and we try to emulate that in captivity as well, is that when bonobo females reach sexual maturity, so about, let's say, 9 to 13 years old, you are never going to be cooler than mom and her friends, and mom and her friends are in charge. So the bonobo females will emigrate out of the group. And so we are, you know, actively speaking with the other organizations and saying, hey, like, if you've got a young female, it's time for her to go. Maybe she's rising in the ranks, causing a little trouble. We'd be happy to have her come here. And sort of, we're trying to kind of bring our numbers to even. So we have 3 females and 4 males currently. And it is just it's a small population in captivity and the wild.
Thanks again for that call, Terry. Now, you're working with that group of bonobos there, Amanda. Do they really have distinctive personalities among the group?
Oh, 1,000%. That was my second choice for most surprising thing. They are so unique, and they all have different wants and needs and, senses of humor. Even we have one bonobo who's super goofy, and he plays with the other bonobos. Just, we don't ever go in their enclosures with them, but he'll play with us, you know, through a safe barrier. And we have one bonobo who can be kind of moody. It's a super gray and rainy day here in Des Moines, and he's been laying out under a blanket in the slow rain today. So their personalities are just about as distinct as they come. Argue probably just as unique as human personalities, and that's part of the challenge, right? If we want them to participate in training or a research project, we've got to find what motivates them. So some are very, very motivated by food, and that grape or piece of, or, you know, drink of juice is really motivating. Some are motivated by having some one-on-one time with care staff that they really trust, and some are motivated by play. They don't need a drink of juice; they'd rather just have you tickle their toes. And so, yes, very unique personalities, and that's one of the best things about getting to work with them.
And Amanda, just in our last half minute or so, if people wanted to get involved in bonobo conservation, what kind of groups would you point them toward?
That's a good question. I think you can check out our website for a list of all of our collaborators. It's apeinitiative.org, and then there's collaborators, and that will give you a huge list of researchers working on projects with bonobos kind of around the globe. I think that'd be a great place to start.
Amanda, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Amanda Epping is a UW-Milwaukee alum and director of operations at the APE Initiative in Des Moines, Iowa. It's a research facility dedicated to bonobo research and conservation. She talked to us about her work there and what studying bonobos can teach us about human behavior. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll meet a U.S. Vietnam War vet and a Vietnamese activist who are working together to safely remove unexploded bombs from the long-running conflict in the region. And more Americans identify as LGBTQ in public opinion surveys, and that's especially true of younger generations of Americans. We'll dig into the trends and what's driving them. You can get started right now with an email, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Are you seeing that trend play out in your family, in your community, in your school? Again, email ideas@WPR.org. Then join those conversations. That's tomorrow here on Central Time.